Legend tells us that in 1903, for several nights in a row, the small town of Van Meter was terrorized by a giant bat-like creature. 110 years later, we'll try to uncover the truth. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Chad Lewis, a paranormal investigator and one of the co-authors of the new book, The Van Meter Visitor, A True and Mysterious Encounter with the Unknown. Later in the hour, I'll talk with another paranormal investigator, Darcy McGrath. She teaches paranormal studies at Kirkwood Community College and conducts paranormal investigations with the Quantum Psi Group based in Marion. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Good morning. This hour, we're going to explore the unknown. In 1903, a number of residents of Van Meter, which is a small town about 20 miles southwest of Des Moines, saw a large bat-like creature during the night. More than 100 years later, a team of researchers has tried to discover what really happened. They've written about it in their book, The Van Meter Visitor, A True and Mysterious Encounter with the Unknown. Chad Lewis is one of the authors. He is a psychologist who specializes in this kind of research, and he's written more than 15 books about his investigations. Hello, Chad.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, welcome back to the show. And tell me how the Van Meter story captured your attention. How did you find out about it?
Really, almost by mistake. A few years back, I had done a series of books on old newspaper accounts, the late 1800s, early 1900s. And these were stories of just bizarre deaths, weird people, mysterious lights in the sky. And it kind of got put on the shelf, my Iowa research, because another book pulled me away. So I had 300-400 stories sitting in the back of my filing cabinet. And I was about to take another adventure into Iowa. And we were going to some weird locations, hunting for a place that is said to have a werewolf terrorizing it, a haunted statue that causes your death. But I was looking for that one anchor to have, that one great story. So I started flipping through all the old papers that I had. And lo and behold, I found a paper that talked about Des Moines' new monster, this giant bat-like creature that was actually terrorizing Van Meter. So with that, it all began.
So try to give me an idea. You said that you explore these stories around the turn of the 20th century. Can you set the scene for us? Were there a lot of occurrences that were reported around the turn of the century like this?
Yes, around the 1900s, you have to remember the spiritualist movement, which believed that you could encounter the dead or the deceased through seances and other means, was a national popular movement. People got together on weekends to have seances in their homes. So people were really beginning to believe in the paranormal or the supernatural. And it only takes a brief look at all the newspapers around Iowa to see that people were talking about haunted homes, sea serpents, UFOs in the sky. So it really was a turning point when people were becoming very interested in this offbeat topic.
Can you give me an example of some of the other reportings that may have been taking place in Iowa around that time? I know that there were reports of a giant creature living in Lake Okoboji.
Yes, that was one where several people saw it while out boating. And for lack of a better term, they said it was a giant sea serpent. They said it was at least 15 to 20 feet in length, that they were afraid that it was going to attack some boaters. And the people around the community really took heed of this, and they avoided the lake for some time. And this was just one of the many sea serpents around the United States that were being reported. It was almost, if you were a resort or a luxury dwelling on a lake, you had to have a sea serpent to get tourists to come.
All right. So when you discovered this new creature in 1903 that was terrorizing Van Meter close to Des Moines, what was it about that particular story that really made you want to dig in and find more?
Well, after 20 years of researching the strange and unusual, I get a lot of the same types of reports, a lot of hauntings, a lot of reports of people seeing a Bigfoot-type creature or mysterious lights in the sky. But it's not often that I get an 8-foot-tall giant bat-like creature with a horn that emits lights and a strange odor. So just the bizarreness of it attracted me because I don't often get these reports of such a unique and mysterious creature.
How did you do your investigation? What was left to tell you about this event?
Yeah, unfortunately, Van Meter is a small community. Roughly 1,000 people today. It was roughly 1,000 people in 1903 as well. They don't have a historical society. They don't have a lot of records. Luckily, they do have a wonderful public library. And that's the first place we started. We went in and befriended the local librarian, Jolena Welker, who was not only aware of this story, but very interested and curious about finding more about it as well. And that's where we began. We thought, if this is happening or did happen, we need to really start digging deeper. And I thought this was going to be a fun case, but I thought it was going to be short. I thought in the beginning that this would turn out to be nothing more than a hoax or a practical joke, but I shortly discovered that it wasn't.
Okay, let's talk about what happened or what the record shows happened in 1903. When did this creature first show its face?
Sure. It was Monday night, Tuesday morning, late about 1 a.m., and a local implement dealer, Eugene Griffith, was coming back to Van Meter from business, his day of business. It was late at night when he noticed what appeared to be a strange light hovering over one of the buildings in downtown. He thought it was at first an intruder or a robber, so he got a little bit closer. And as he got close enough to make out what this light was, it simply disappeared and then reappeared across the street in a matter of seconds on another building and then simply disappeared into the night. And Eugene Griffith thought nothing really of it. He talked about it a little bit the next day, but at that point, it was just a weird sighting of a light on the roof. Maybe it really was an intruder.
And Mr. Griffith, was he someone who people respected, whose opinions were trusted?
Yes. A lot of the history books talk about him being a well-respected, prominent businessman. He had a business with his brother, the Griffith Brothers Implement. And at this point, remember, back in this time period, rural Iowa, your reputation was the most important thing for you, especially for business people. If you wanted to invest or buy something from a business person, you may not want to buy one from people seeing 8-foot giant bat creatures. So these people took a great chance with coming out with their story because, again, your reputation was key.
And at that time in 1903, you wouldn't have seen a lot of lights flitting around at night.
Right. It's not like going out today where you can see everything in the night sky and around. It was a dark, dark place, so any light would stand out. And that's what caught the attention of Mr. Griffith as he was traveling back into town. And he thought, again, that it was somebody maybe scouting the bank or looking to rob one of the other businesses in downtown Van Meter.
Okay, so he tells this story and probably dismisses it himself, I would think. What happens next?
Well, the very next night, we have one of the doctors in town, again, a well-respected man. He was sleeping above his building, above the office, and all of a sudden—
In an apartment, right.
Yeah, right above. A lot of these business owners back then would sleep right above their business in an apartment that they had in the same building. And he, all of a sudden, a bright light was shining on his face. Well, he wasn't taking any chances. Dr. Alcott, grabbed his gun, which the paper said was of immense proportions, and he ran outside, and he was the first to see what he described as being a half-human, half-animal that had great bat-like wings and some light that seemed to come from a blunt horn that grew out of its forehead. Well, give Mr. Alcott a lot of credit because he actually fired at the creature. 5 of his 6 shots at extremely close range, he fired at the creature, and then he saved the last bullet and ran inside and barred himself and waited until morning where he could see what took place. He was so frightened that after the shot seemed to have no effect, he ran and retreated.
So you found that story, but you couldn't find out very much about Dr. Alcott.
No, they're listed throughout history as a lot of Alcotts in the area. We believe it's Mr. Fred Alcott, who did graduate from the Van Meter Public Schools, but we don't have any photographs, we don't have any records, we don't have any family members in the area. A lot of Dr. Alcott, much like this case, remains a mystery.
So at that point, do we know how other people in town were reacting to this story? First, somebody had seen a strange light, and then somebody's firing off a weapon in the middle of the night. Do you know what the reactions were of people?
Well, it seemed as though they were starting to gain traction of people being terrorized by this creature. One thing to see a ball of light hovering over a store. It's another thing to see this giant bat-like creature that you shot at and it had no effect. And in the morning, when he was brave enough to come out in the sunlight, he noticed that there were no feathers on the ground, no pieces of blood, or other indication that he had hit the creature. And at this point, word quickly spread through the small town that something was amiss.
Okay, but since there was no evidence, or were there even footprints on the ground? I mean, was there anything left to indicate that anything had been there?
If there were any of those things, it was not mentioned by the newspaper account. It may have been mentioned in someone's journal that we just haven't discovered yet. But outside of this, all we have right now are the two people who actually saw it. Others may have seen it as well, but they just weren't recorded in the newspaper account.
Okay, what happens next?
Well, this is when things start to get really weird, if it wasn't weird already. The next night, the local bank manager, fearing that this is nothing more than bank robbers trying to scare the town, grabs his shotgun loaded with buckshot and heads down to protect the bank. And he's inside the bank when a light comes shining in on him. In fact, he described that light was so bright that it nearly blinded him. So what he did is watch the light for a while, and then he could not take it any longer, and he blasted out the front windows of the bank, shooting at this creature. He shot at it, and again, it seemed to have no effect, and he ran back in and took cover and waited for morning as well.
So he actually blew out the windows of the bank.
He did, and I'd imagine there would be some photographs of this or for insurance purposes, but again, nothing surfaced. The next morning, he went out expecting to find a dead body, but all he found was giant three-toed tracks on the outside of the building, one of which he said to have taken a plaster cast of, which we haven't found. It may be in one of your listeners' attic right now, but this giant three-toed footprint, if you will, was around the building showing that someone or something was there, but again, the bullet seemed to have no effect.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and we will get back to talking about this strange creature that terrorized Van Meter, Iowa in 1903. With me is Chad Lewis. He is one of the co-authors of the book, The Van Meter Visitor, A True and Mysterious Encounter with the Unknown. If anyone in your family had passed down stories of this event or others like it, we'd love to hear your story. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Chad Lewis. He is one of the co-authors of the new book, The Van Meter Visitor, A True and Mysterious Encounter with the Unknown. He and his co-authors investigated sightings of a giant bat-like creature that apparently took place in 1903 in Van Meter, Iowa. And just before the break, Chad, we were talking about how, again, someone had fired on the creature, but it seemed to be unharmed. It disappeared, but this time it left behind a footprint. Can you tell me how the town was reacting at this point? Do we know?
Well, now the town was on full alert. Everybody was out watching for this thing at night. And now it is Thursday night, Friday morning, October 2nd, when a local hardware man, Ovi White, was sleeping above his store when he was woken up by strange sounds. He was on alert, so he went out, looked out the window, and saw this creature apparently sleeping on a telephone pole. He grabbed his gun, took deliberate aim, shot the creature, but instead of killing it, it seemed to have only woken the creature up, and the creature shined its light on him, And here's the strange part. It emitted an odor that Ovi White said he could not remember what happened after that odor hit him, as though it was some memory-erasing odor. At the same time, another businessman across the street heard the gunshot. Sidney Gregg, he rushed to the window and saw this creature descending the telephone pole using its beak like a giant parrot. And he said when it got to the ground, it was 8 feet high when it stood up, and it gave off a light from its forehead as bright as an electric headlight, and then it ran through town and flew off toward the old abandoned coal mine.
All right, and there was an old abandoned coal mine on the edge of town, so people decided that that's where it was emerging from?
Yes, they thought that had to be the only place this thing could come to or come from. So the next night, Friday night, Saturday morning of the 3rd, the last sighting, people gathered around this old mine. And sure enough, about 1 a.m., the creature flew out. They shot at it, no effect. Where it went, we don't know. But a few hours later, just before daybreak, the creature came back. Now, by now, at this moment, there were dozens upon dozens of local brick and tile factory workers with their guns there waiting. And when the creature came back, the most bizarre thing happened. Another creature joined it, a smaller one. So now there's two of these bat-like creatures in the opening of the mine. And of course, all of the men let loose with their fire. The paper said that it was enough firepower to sink a Spanish fleet. But again, it had no effect, and the creature simply descended down into the coal mine shaft and were never seen from again.
Never again.
Well, the newspaper left off that the town was in full excitement, and they tried to barricade the old mine, and the townsfolks were getting together to find out the best way to extinguish these creatures. And then, much like a Hollywood script, the newspaper ended. That was it.
So, as you read through these accounts, I mean, you mentioned earlier the sea serpent sightings, that every community that had a lake and cabins and luxury houses along the lake needed to have a sea serpent. Are there other sightings of things like this? Could this have been a trend? Did every small town need a giant bat-like creature?
Well, this bat-like creature wasn't as prevalent as sea serpents or haunted homes or haunted places you could visit. But there were several sightings in that time period. Just a few weeks before the Van Meter visitor occurred, out in Utah, a very similar creature was seen stealing horses and flying off in the night sky with these. And of course, out in New Jersey, they had the New Jersey Devil, which was terrorizing people of the Pine Barrens there. So there were several of these very similar sightings, but not nearly to the extent of hauntings or sea serpents or other bizarre creatures roaming our woods.
All right. And in your book, I'm not sure it was you, but someone wrote about there was a legend of a similar creature that apparently the Native Americans had or a Native American tribe had talked about and shared a story about, right?
Yes, a lot of the native peoples to Iowa were talking about these thunderbirds, these giant birds with wings that they considered to rule the sky and fight with the sea serpents in the water. And a lot of similarities exist on the size, shape, and detail of these thunderbirds and the Van Meter visitor or whatever this creature was. So it's quite possible that the Native Americans had also encountered this creature, but unfortunately we have no written record of that.
And this creature didn't hurt anybody?
Not that we know of. Again, all we have are the newspaper accounts of the sightings. There are no witnesses left living. Even their descendants haven't come forward and said we have great-grandfather's journal or something of that nature that would give us more insight. So it really is a mystery. But as far as we know, this creature was all but harmless besides invoking fear in nearly the whole town.
What were the theories that the people of the town explored? I mean, did they think it came from space? Did they think it came from underground? Do you know?
We don't know. We can only suggest based on what their beliefs were on other paranormal activity going on. I assume many of them thought it was nothing more than a form of mass hysteria, which we look at in the book as well, that many of these people thought maybe their neighbors, if they hadn't seen it themselves, they thought their neighbors had gotten caught up in a lot of the commotion and the excitement of it. I'm sure many of them thought it was something that came from the mine, just some undiscovered creature. Remember, in 1903, we had just officially discovered the mountain gorilla, and new species of animal were being discovered nearly every month. So people were in that mindset that with science growing, anything was possible. Well, of course there could be a creature down in the mine. There was a creature in the jungle that nobody knew about, and now it's the gorilla. So I think a lot of people thought maybe it was just an undiscovered creature.
All right. We'd love to hear from you. If you have stories like this that have been passed down in your family, you can let us know. 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPR Talk. Or, you know, why do you think these stories do fascinate? How does something like this catch on? Things like this still happen. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. And Dave is on the line from Norwalk. Hi, Dave.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So I'm fascinated. Two things I need to know. Where do I get the book? And is this thing the same as the Mothman or the Jersey Devil or the Skinwalkers? I mean, what have you found out that how it relates to each thing? And I got to run, take my answer off the air, but please tell me where to get the book. Thanks.
All right, Dave, thanks a lot for your call. Chad?
Yeah, certainly. I think Iowa Public Radio will have a link to our website, thevanmeetervisitor.com, and you can get the book there or support your favorite local bookstore as well. But more importantly, was it similar to the Mothman? Yes, we touch on it. My co-author Kevin Lee Nelson talks a bit about the Mothman out in West Virginia, Point Pleasant, that occurred very similar, the winged creature. And a lot of people saw this Mothman as flying with giant wings, but it was never flapping the wings, much like the Van Meter visitor seemed to have these wings, but it never used them. So there are a lot of similarities with the bright light and the odor coming off with the Mothman and the Jersey Devil. But again, it seems to be completely separate from that as well.
And we do also have a link to your website, thevanmeetervisitor.com, up on our Facebook page as well. You can leave your comments there also. William is on the line next from Waverly. Hi, William.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm not a native of Iowa. I actually grew up down close to St. Louis, and we had a myth of a large bird. In fact, it's painted on the bluff in the high school that I spent a couple of years ago. It was actually our mascot, but the story, it was called the Piasol Bird, and it was from Native American legend that this bird had existed. And so it was part of our folklore, even where we lived, even in our high school.
Interesting. William, thanks a lot for sharing that.
You're welcome. Thanks. Bye.
And large flying creatures do seem to make a lot of appearances in a lot of different stories, don't they?
They do, all through Native American legend and folklore. Even when the white pioneers first started settling the areas, they too saw these creatures and believed in them and respected them as fearful creatures that, if you weren't careful, they could take your life. And maybe some people in Van Meter were telling their kids they had to be home on time or the creature would come and get them.
So, Chad, you have done investigations all over the world of different stories, unknown happenings. In looking into this investigation, how compelling is the evidence that you found?
Oh, great question. I think the evidence that we found leaves it. It's a 110-year-old mystery, and unfortunately, it's going to be a 111-year-old mystery as well, that we don't have a lot of solutions. We have more questions than answers. But I think when it comes to the paranormal, that's par for the course, that we don't know the answers to a lot of these things. And maybe it's the mystery that I think is the most compelling. If we could, without any qualms about it, say that this was a misidentified pelican or a whooping crane, that wouldn't be nearly as much fun as saying we have no idea what this thing was or is. Here are some of the theories that we have, but really it's open to interpretation. We have several people in Van Meter who, looking at the story, believe that it was a demon of some sort visiting their town. And of course, they believe that hopefully it's still not visiting them.
Compared to some of the other investigations you've done, how does this one stack up?
This was one of the most difficult investigations I've ever done, just by the fact that there was so little information to go on and it took such an amount of digging. Luckily, again, the librarian, Jolena Welker of Van Meter, we befriended her and she introduced us to a lot of the old timers in Van Meter who as kids remembered hearing this story. They even have memories of many of the witnesses from this story, and they told us that these were upstanding, prominent citizens. One was a postmaster, one was a bank manager, one went on to become the mayor. So these were great people, but it took so much work to dig this up. Now, if we were looking at a case in Des Moines in 1903, it would be a lot easier. You walk into the State Historical Society, and they have more information than you could ever possibly want. That was the exact opposite of Van Meter. And some people even claim that maybe that's the way they wanted it, that they wanted to forget this right away and get rid of any indication that it ever happened.
So, Chad, what do you think it was?
Great question. I ruled out that it was a hoax. Remember I said when I first got there, I thought it was a hoax. But after thinking that either the people of Van Meter are the worst shots in the world after shooting at this creature or that it was something else, I don't think it was a hoax. I don't think it was mass hysteria. I'm open to the idea that it was some unknown creature living in the mine. I'm open to the idea that maybe it was a being visiting us from a different planet or maybe a different dimension. But again, I don't know. I'm as baffled now as I was when I started this. And for me, I guess I'm okay with that now.
How did you get started investigating events like this?
I blame it on my home state of Wisconsin. I grew up near one of the three UFO capitals of the world that our state has. And when I was in high school, I started interviewing people that had thought they had seen UFOs in the sky at a UFO capital, Elmwood, Wisconsin. So when I started studying psychology, I was really interested in why do people believe in the strange and unusual? And I started looking at belief systems and human perception, and I was presenting this research at symposiums, very statistical stuff, very boring, you're glad you weren't there. But people in the audience would come up and say, I know this isn't really what you're doing, but I think my home is haunted, or I saw something in the woods I can't explain. Could you help me investigate? So that's really where it began, that I started turning my research from what do people believe in to what's actually happening.
Did you believe in this kind of thing when you first started?
I wouldn't say I was a believer or a skeptic. I try to remain in the middle where I think I am today of not knowing. I don't know if a lot of these cases are true or not. Many of them we've been able to debunk or dispel. Others have left us baffled. But I think I try to approach each case of seeing where does the evidence lead me? Because when you're dealing with the weird, what's too weird?
When you were looking to find the answer of why do people believe in the strange and unusual, was there something you were hoping to find?
I think like everybody, I was looking for answers to the questions that we have asked since human thought began of are we alone in the universe? What happens when we die? These types of questions. Have we discovered every known living being? Are there other planets with life or dimensions with life? And I think those are the questions that I don't think will ever be answered, at least not in my lifetime. And maybe they're not meant to be answered.
Judy is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
And you have a story that's been passed down in your family similar to this one.
Well, yes. It was really kind of a hoax. I've heard this story, just heard it a few weeks ago when I was down in Kentucky again about my grandfather and a friend of his. They called it the Dumbbell, and they'd wind up this thing, and I guess it made an awful noise, and they'd wind it up in the middle of the night and just to scare people. And then people would say, oh, I saw it. It was had huge teeth and a tail. And unfortunately, I think a lot of these people were African Americans at the time. And they were actually just, and then they would laugh about it, you know, but it was just kind of a thing that went on for quite a while. And then I found out, just talking with my cousin, that my grandmother actually went out and wound it up one time, too.
So I'm sure, Chad, you have encountered a lot of people who have wanted to scare other people in and try to make them believe that there was something supernatural going on.
Yes, and we have to remember, during this time period, there were other well-known hoaxes going on as well as the Cardiff Giant, this
right.
giant creature that was said to have been dug up, the Hodag of Wisconsin, these lumberjacks saw this giant creature, the Fiji Mermaid. So these hoaxes were going on at all times. Usually they were meant as a tourist draw to get people to come to these towns, where in Van Meter it was the exact opposite. Many residents wrote into the local paper saying, there's nothing to see here. Well, there's a little to see, but not quite a bat, so don't come looking for it, which, much like today, has the exact opposite effect, that stay away, don't come here, there's nothing to see, entices people to come see.
All right. Well, Chad, thank you so much for sharing this story with us today.
Hey, keep an eye out.
All right. Chad Lewis is one of the co-authors of the new book, The Van Meter Visitor, a true and mysterious encounter with the unknown. In 1903, a strange bat-like creature that emitted light from a horn on its head, apparently, terrorized the town of Van Meter for a number of nights in a row. We're going to continue our conversation about the paranormal, the unexplained, in just a moment. Darcy McGrath will join us. She is a paranormal investigator, and she teaches paranormal studies at Kirkwood Community College. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're going to continue to explore the unknown this hour on Talk of Iowa. Darcy McGrath is here with me now. She is a paranormal investigator. She teaches paranormal studies at Kirkwood Community College. She also conducts paranormal investigations with a quantum psi group based in Marion. And she has traveled the nation working on other investigations as well. Hello, Darcy.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for being here today. And you have been doing paranormal research for 35 years?
Correct.
Okay. You don't look old enough to have done this for 35 years. So tell me how this started for you.
Never get in trouble with the librarian. I'll tell you that straight up. They were doing a Halloween ghost stories around Halloween. I think I was about 8 years old. And I was messing around in the back of the class. So the assistant librarian came around back and said, so what's going on? Come on, it's Halloween. Aren't you into this? This is great. I put my hands on my hips and I touted the parental party line. There's no such thing as ghosts. This is kid stuff. And she said, really? Come with me. And she took me over to the nonfiction section. And she handed me Larry Kettelkamp's Haunted Houses. I still have it on my bookshelf. read that book cover to cover, and I was hooked. I was fascinated there was something that science could not explain.
So reading about things like this is one thing. When did you first encounter something that made you think, I'm experiencing something that I can't explain?
Well, that interest has followed me through my entire life, all the way up through college. When I was 12 years old, they tested my reading level, and they said I had a college-level reading level because I was reading like Dr. Hans Holzer. I was reading Dr. William Roll. I was reading all these parapsychologists that had written all these books. So it wasn't until I got to my dormitory in college that I had my little student guide. I opened it up, and it said, by the way, just to let you know, the dormitory is haunted. There's a ghost by the name of Augie, and just to let you know, he's there. He's a prankster. He won't hurt anybody. It's fine. And I was just like, awesome.
And this was at UNI,
yes,
University
correct.
Of Northern Iowa.
Yeah.
At what dormitory?
It's pretty well documented. Lother Hall.
All right. Well, if not to those of us who didn't go to UNI.
Oh.
All right. And now, there are lots of ghosts that haunt dormitories. I know that there sure. are stories about them at the University of Iowa, stories mm-hmm. at Iowa State. Mm-hmm. So how did you encounter this ghost?
Well, I just started digging into research mode. I went down to the library, started digging up all the newspaper clippings, talked to some of the eyewitnesses that had experienced stuff, and just started compiling all this information. And then all of a sudden, stuff started happening in our dorm room. The lights would come on by themselves off. The doors would lock at most inopportune moments, usually in very awkward situations where we needed to get back in the door. got in trouble with security because they swore we lost our key. We had gotten locked out 25 times. And so it got to a point that I finally just started talking out loud, saying, okay, you know, could you please stop doing this? We're going to get in trouble. And it stopped. It's like, oh my gosh, it can hear us. It's like, and there's a little quote in, speaking of Chad Lewis's book, in the Mothman Prophecy, there's a line in there that says, you notice them, and they notice that you notice them. And that's very, very true in this field.
Well, and you know, a lot of people say that events like this, non-believers tend to say, well, the people who go looking for ghosts find ghosts, and the people who don't go looking for ghosts don't find ghosts. So if what you're saying is true, that if you're looking for a ghost, if you notice it, it notices you, mm-hmm. that that would be a pattern that a lot of people have noticed.
Yeah.
What did your roommate think of this?
My roommate was a skeptic, or at least she was leading me on to believe she was a skeptic. She didn't believe much of what was going on until I started noticing that when I was taking weekends off to go home, she would go home. And she'd get really mad if I decided at the last minute I was going home, because then she would have to make arrangements to go home. And I'm like, what is going on? Why do you have to go home? Well, I don't want to be here by myself. So, yeah, that kind of came out in an awkward way.
So from that experience, where did that lead you?
I started applying what I learned. I had had almost like 15 years experience reading all these books and stuff. I started applying the knowledge to see if it would actually work. And in a lot of cases, it did. And so...
Okay, tell me how you applied. I mean, you told the ghost at Lowther Hall that you didn't want him to get you in trouble anymore, and he stopped. But tell me how you applied what you had learned in other ways.
Well, first of all, I did learn from other cases that you could talk to them, but their voices may not appear out of thin air. You may have to use different devices to do it. So then I had my... They didn't have digital recorders back then, so that's dating me a bit. But they had miniature tape recorders. And so we ran around trying to catch voices on that. Unfortunately, I wasn't really good at hearing those back then, but my ear got better and better as the years went. And we were able to capture stuff that we couldn't explain.
As time went on, can you give me an example of an investigation that you were involved in where you felt that you found clear evidence that there was something there?
Well, we spent a lot of time down in South Central Iowa, a little place called Mason House Inn out of Bensport, Iowa. We call it Paranormal Disneyland because every time we go down there, we get tons and tons of stuff. Lots of audio that where we're asking questions and we'll get answers on the recorder when we play it back. And a lot of times our group is mainly consisting of females. We'll get male voices responding to us, and there's obviously no males in the room. The doors are shut. The place is pretty well tied up, you know, as far as a carryover and voices and stuff like that. And so audio is probably our heaviest thing.
These are things that you couldn't hear when you were in the room, but if you record what's going on in the room, you can hear it later?
Correct. Yeah. It's what the theory is on that is that they are using energy in order to communicate with. So they are impressing their electromagnetic field on the device, which also is designed to pick up electromagnetic fields, whether that be your tape recorder, your camera, your camcorder. And then they imprint the information on there. So when you play it back, then you hear it or then you see it.
I'm talking with Darcy McGrath. She is a paranormal investigator. She teaches paranormal studies at Kirkwood Community College. And if you've ever had an experience that convinced you that perhaps you were encountering a ghost or another supernatural being, we'd love to hear your story. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org is our email address. You can also post on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. You had a frightening experience when you went down to a place called Pippin Castle in Springfield, Missouri. First tell us what Pippin Castle is?
Pythian,
I'm sorry.
That's okay. It was built shortly after the Civil War to house the infirm soldiers that were coming home. And so a lot of the Civil War veterans stayed there for quite a while. Abraham Lincoln actually wrote a letter of commendation for developing such a thing, calling such a facility as something that would heal the nation after the war. But shortly after that, after the Civil War population started to slowly decline, they started taking on orphans, and other infirm that could not take care of themselves. So there were orphans there. There were older, elderly people there, people that were sick, maybe not mentally stable. So they went there. But during the 1940s and 50s, the United States military overtook the facility and used it as a USO headquarters. But what wasn't heavily known is that they used the lower levels of the basement to house POWs from Germany. And I think they even had some from Japan. But the German ones were the worst of the worst. Those were the ones from Auschwitz and the concentration camps. So they were pretty bad. This wasn't revealed to us until we got there, which was unusual because we usually have a pretty good researcher when we go there, so we're ready for this. So going down into that basement, it was very, very heavy, very, very ominous. You could just feel it. And I don't scare that easy because I've been doing this for such a long time. But my team had accidentally wandered off, and before I knew it, I turned around, and I was by myself in this cell, and you could just feel the heaviness and the crowdedness in that cell. I knew it wasn't by myself. And some of the EVPs that we actually collected later actually hinted at there was not something so nice in there. And it decided to go home with me.
How did you know?
Rather unique circumstance, actually. I was having really bad insomnia. I kept hearing these noises at night, like things were just crashing and falling apart in the next room. And I go and go look, and there's nothing there. And this would repeatedly happen. Until almost two nights, I wasn't getting any sleep at all because it would just keep happening. The moment I was just falling asleep, that's when it would occur. And I'm like, okay, this isn't good. Something's going on here. Well, I went to my class, and one of the gals there was a developing medium, which I didn't know. She just shared that with me that night. And she pulled me aside, and she goes, you need to know you got something with you. You need to take care of that right now. It is evil. It's bad. And I'm going home. I'm like, oh. So it took a couple of nights using every tool I had in my arsenal. And then when that didn't work, I ended up having to call on some higher power, and it eventually was gone.
Explain that to me. How did you call upon a higher power?
Well, I had been working with some energy circles, trying to study and see how they work and stuff. And they started talking about things called spirit guides. And they said, everybody's got one. It's kind of like your guardian angels, that sort of thing. And I was just out of everything I had. I had tried smudging. I had tried prayers. I'd tried holy water, everything I could to try to shake this thing loose. It would not go away. So I finally, after a third night of fatigue and not being able to sleep, I just threw myself back in the chair and I said, I'm sorry. I don't know what else to do. Please would you come down and just take this thing away? And the cats were the first ones to start acting up, that something had come into the room with us. And slowly but surely, after 20 minutes, that heaviness I had been feeling for the last three nights started to lift. And just couldn't explain it.
Let's go to the phones. Aaron is on the line from Iowa City. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I was a big fan of Art Bell's paranormal radio show, Coast to Coast AM. And on that show, he had a guest that would come in. He was a paranormal investigator, and he would play EVPs. And what Art observed was that before he would play the EVP, he would suggest what the listener was going to hear. And when he would make that suggestion, the listener would hear that. But when he wouldn't make the suggestion first, after Art would prompt him not to, nobody could figure out what was said on the EVP. So I'm wondering how much of that phenomenon is putting the suggestion in the person's mind, or the person just wanting to hear something rather than actually hearing something. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Aaron, thanks a lot for your call. I'm sure that's something you've heard before.
Oh, yeah, and I run into that, too, because I've been listening to this stuff for so long. Your ear can become attuned to it. And I notice this a lot with musicians, too, that tended to go into this field, too, is that they can pick up on the frequencies and anomalies that not everybody can pick up on. So to them, it may sound as clear as day. How can you not possibly hear it? But the other person will go, I'm not hearing it. So a lot of times I have to turn my stuff over to other people and say, can you hear this? You know, I try not to tell them what I got before I got it, just to see if they pick up the same things I do. But it's not always true.
Teaching at Kirkwood Community College, can you tell me, when the students come to your classes, what are they looking for? I mean, I can imagine that there is a wide variety. There are probably the true believers. There are probably people who are just looking to have fun.
You know, I got a different clientele altogether than what I was expecting. You know, I started teaching the classes. It was basically to educate the public, which is what our group is all about, is education. The more education you have, the less fear you're going to have. You know, because they're seeing everybody, all the stuff's on TV and it's on the movies and all that kind of stuff. And I was trying to get across, okay, it's not like this. And I assumed the people coming to class were going to be coming because of that stuff. A lot of them were coming from much more deeper spiritual questions than I ever expected. Some of them were on the verge of losing someone, or they had lost someone very close to them, and they wanted to know what happened to them. Or are their loved ones in danger of becoming ghosts and trapped and in a bad place? And so it really was quite unexpected, the draw that I got there.
Interesting. Kim is on the line from Rock Island. Hi, Kim.
Well, and happy Tuesday. I myself was a skeptic. I have a friend who, she seemed to be one of those people, like your guest, that is in tune to these things. And I rented a place one time that had strange, it felt weird. And then one day I saw a weird glow, and I asked her to come by, which she was going to do like the next week. Well, that day that I called her, later in the day, she had, like, I guess a premonition or whatever. The little girl's name was The Glow, was a little girl, and her name was Lisa, and that she liked the house. She told me information about the house that there's no way she actually knew, you know, as far as when it was built and different things, and that to tell her to go to the light, that her family was waiting. So on the phone, I'm laughing about it, and I'm saying this to the house. And just as I finished that, I actually saw a man. I mean, not like a glow of a man, but there was actually a man standing on my foyer that was, like, very well-dressed, early 1900s, and I'm, like, saying things to my friend Karen, oh, my gosh, and she's like, he's there for Lisa, and so I started to say something to him about going to the light, and as I stood up, my view was blocked for a second, and, of course, when I could see that area again, he wasn't there, but I'm sorry, you know what I mean? It was like, how else can you explain it? So. Well, I believe.
Kim, thank you so much for sharing your story. And I'm guessing that in your encounters with people who do believe, it must be an experience that causes them to believe in most cases.
Yeah, most of the time they do. I do have some people that come to me that absolutely did not believe in a thing until they moved into this house or took over this property or had to manage this place. And so it's kind of funny when the skeptics say that, oh, well, you're looking for ghosts, you find them. Well, there's sometimes people take over places, they don't want it. And that's usually when they end up calling me. So try to explain to them what's going on.
Well, there are a lot of skeptics in the world. What do you want people to know about your beliefs?
What I've encountered over the years, and one of the things that's intrigued me the most, is that there are such things as called spirits and visitation. And, you know, they've hyped it a lot on Hollywood and all that kind of stuff. Ooh, they're there to scare you. They're there to frighten you. They're there to kill you. No, no, no. A lot of times what you end up with spirits and visitations, spirits that have had attachment to the property, have lived there before, had a wonderful experience there. They have crossed over and they've decided to come back. Some will do what they call, they will inhabit the building, and they're not there to hurt anybody. They would never hurt anybody. They're very, very kind, generous, benevolent souls. They would never hurt anyone. But they just love the house. They like to be there. And there's nothing chaotic or angry or upsetting about them. So there are spirits that do cross over and come back by choice.
Darcy, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Sure.
Darcy McGrath is a paranormal investigator. She teaches paranormal studies at Kirkwood Community College. Talk of Iowa is produced by Sarah Bowden, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we'll explore extreme sports in Iowa, and I will jump out of an airplane with Paradise Skydives in Vinton. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.